from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the opening hour of this morning's edition, Israeli and Palestinian officials are set to resume peace talks tonight in Washington, D.C. It's the first time both parties have held direct talks since 2010. Secretary of State John Kerry had been shuttling back and forth to the Middle East to encourage a meeting. And last night, the Israeli cabinet also signaled a move toward talks, voting to approve the release of 104 Palestinian prisoners. We discussed the conditions of reviving Palestinian-Israeli peace discussions and the likelihood for success. That's next on Forum. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Israeli and Palestinian officials are set to begin peace talks in Washington, D.C. tonight. It's the first time both parties have held direct talks since 2010. The Israeli cabinet also removed another barrier to talks, voting yesterday to approve the release of 104 Palestinian prisoners. And U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been busy on his end this past month, traveling back and forth six times to the Middle East, trying to reset the discussion. And we want to focus in this hour on the peace talks and what they are likely to produce. And we have a number of analysts with us. We wanted first, though, to go to Washington and welcome Indira Lakshmanan, who is senior correspondent who covers foreign policy for Bloomberg News and has been traveling with Secretary of State John Kerry. And Indira Lakshmanan, welcome to Forum. Good morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you, and glad to sort of cast this and frame this perhaps as best we can. Initially, are we talking here about peace negotiations, or are we talking about just kind of setting up procedure and the framework for peace talks?
I think the latter is the initial conversation, but even getting to that point has been a very big deal that has required major shuttle diplomacy by John Kerry that you referred to over the last 6 months, six visits to the region, and just in the last few months, really intensive negotiations, including back and forth trips over the course of a week, just to get each side to say to him what they were unwilling to say to one another. So the talks tonight between Israel's Justice Minister Zippy Livni and the chief Palestinian negotiator Saeed Erekat at the State Department will be sort of setting the ground rules for the talks to come.
So Mohammad Shadier, the Abu Mazen aide, and Yitzhak Molchka, who have also been mentioned here, Netanyahu's special envoy, will not be involved in this talks?
They will be, but of course the leaders of it are the two who I mentioned, and the others will be there as sort of aides and specific go-betweens for the leaders, Netanyahu and Abbas, respectively. Another really important development that happened today was about an hour ago, the State Department, John Kerry, announced that he was naming a new special envoy to sort of shepherd these Middle East talks, and that's a very well-known figure here in town, Martin Indyk, who was twice U.S. ambassador to Israel under Bill Clinton, and we could say two times got very close to the brink of trying to get a Mideast peace deal, but in neither case was able to do it. So bringing sort of a time-tested person back onto the stage.
Martin Indyk is also ambassador to Turkey, I believe, and he is now in the New Israel Fund, which has raised a lot of questions. I know he's apparently, from what I read, trusted by Abu Mazen and actually has been a very strong force in trying to broker peace, to put it mildly. And yet at the same time, he is a member of a Zionist organization and he's Jewish.
And he did start out his career as a research director at AIPAC, the America-Israel Political Affairs Committee. So, you know, he does have that background. At the same time, obviously, both sides agreed to him as a go-between and as a special envoy, or he wouldn't have been named to that position. So I think there is trust in him. He made a joke today that his son had 15 years ago made a screensaver for him saying, "Dad, is there peace in the Middle East yet?" And that up until now, he's been able to say no, sadly, every day. And so I think he was one of the key people, you know, in behind the scenes among the sort of top Middle East experts that we have in Washington who've been in and out of government, who has been counseling John Kerry that you better grab this opportunity now or you may never get it again. And I think he's been quietly saying the same things to both sides and the Palestinian-Israeli struggle as well, that if you don't act now, that there might not be another opportunity for having a two-state solution and having peace.
What presumably makes this time more propitious, though? I mean, 20 years ago, well, there have been 20 years of really no progress, no results. And as I had mentioned earlier, in 2010, talks ended after 3 weeks with Israel refusing the demand for extending on the settlements. There must be, at least, and I'm sure there's a lot of speculation about what has been offered under the table by John Kerry.
Well, you make an excellent point, and on that specific point of the settlements, Israel has not yet agreed to any kind of a settlement freeze, and it was that that caused the talks to fall down last time. What they did do that you referred to was agreeing to release more than 100 Palestinians who had been involved in attacks on Israelis who've all served more than 20 years in prison, and that's something that, you know, is a big political cost for Netanyahu and is a very unpopular decision. In terms of what might be different now, I think that both sides are seeing that in the context of the Arab awakening and a lot of the conflict that we're seeing in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Syria, and, you know, the instability in Lebanon, that they may need to seize the moment and get this done if they can. I mean, John Kerry himself has referred to this issue as the granddaddy of all international problems. And we know that he believes that if this problem can be solved while it's not in crisis mode, while the crisis is elsewhere, that it may provide a larger opportunity to take the heat off of other Middle Eastern problems. So I think it's gotten to the point where you have constituencies in both groups, in Israel and among the Palestinians, who are just worried that if they don't do something now, there may never be a possibility for a two-state solution. The demographics are certainly against the Jews in Israel, and that the Palestinians are growing at a larger, you know, a quicker speed. So if they want to maintain a Jewish state, then they need to make a separate Palestinian state. So I think on both sides there's an understanding that the time may be now, and Kerry has privately talked about trying to do a 9-month timeline for getting things done. He's trying to put a deadline on it to, you know, light a fire under people on this issue.
And what about the, I think, $4 billion that's gone into the Palestinian territories for private investment? Does that have to be figured into this?
Yes, it's something that was announced. I was actually on a trip with Kerry when he brought that up, and that was in Jordan. He made that announcement at the Dead Sea at a World Economic Forum meeting, and it's something that is actually marshaling funds from the private sector and trying to get big corporations, including some big American corporations, involved in putting investment into the Palestinian territories. Now, I don't think that that alone is going to make the difference, but it's certainly one of the sweeteners that Kerry was able to offer into the deal.
Again, Indira Lakshmananan is senior correspondent covering foreign policy with Bloomberg News. She's been traveling with Secretary of State John Kerry, and I thank you for joining us. Appreciate your being with us this morning.
Nice talking to you. Thanks.
Good to talk to you. And we want to talk now to Ambassador Dennis Ross, who's joining us by phone, counselor with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former special assistant to both President Obama and National Security Council senior director for the Central Region. And Dennis Ross, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Well, how optimistic are you?
Well, I'm hopeful. Obviously, I'm having worked on this issue for as long as I have, there's probably something congenital about my optimism. I wouldn't say that one should assume that there's an imminent breakthrough, but I do think there is a context now that creates a possibility, and I think that context in a paradoxical way is related to the rest of the region. You think about it, you have turmoil and upheaval everywhere, and for a while I think that created a real chilling effect on both Prime Minister Netanyahu and on President Abbas. But it also, I think, has created a circumstance where they each also understand that this creates a kind of space for them as well. The rest of the region is completely consumed and preoccupied. And because of that, it creates a certain freedom for them to deal with this issue and face less of a likelihood of backlash from the rest of the region. And who knows how long that moment's going to last, and who knows how long, if you don't do something, the Palestinian Authority itself is going to last. So this becomes a reason for both of them to see if there's something that can be done. And they do have, in the Secretary of State, someone who's made a very clear commitment to make a real effort with them. And they both have confidence in him. And I think that helps to create a sense of a moment.
What about, you use the word backlash, what about the backlash, for example, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is already feeling from the right, from the far right in Israel, that is to his right, and for that matter that the Palestinian Authority and Abu Mazen are feeling as a result of Hamas saying they want nothing to do with these peace negotiations?
Well, let's take them in order. In the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu, look, he's just done something that costs him. There's no doubt. And when you do something that costs you, that's a measure of seriousness. He is, by making this decision to release prisoners, these are the pre-Oslo prisoners, meaning these are the ones who've been held since before the Oslo process. They've been held because they killed Israelis. It's not just that they carried out attacks, they killed Israelis.
And forgive me, Dennis, I want to make an important point here. Some of them include Arab-Israeli citizens, and there's been a separation or an attempt by Israel to separate those two.
That's correct. There's 104 that are in jail from that constitute the pre-Oslo, and I think 19 are Israeli Arabs. So he's the prime minister has paid a price. He's understood that anything he does is going to create a reaction from the right. And yet, it, as I said, this becomes a kind of indication of his seriousness. In the case of President Abbas, in an interesting way, look, he knows anything he does is going to produce a negative reaction from Hamas. But because of what's happening in Egypt, Hamas has just become weakened. It was one thing when the Muslim Brotherhood dominated Egypt. It's something else now when they've been displaced, and Egypt is clearly in a period of instability. But Egypt is no longer a source of great strength for Hamas, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is no longer a source of great strength for Hamas. So they're somewhat weakened in terms of what they can do with regard to their opposition to Abbas, and that creates, I think, a bit more of a sense of moment for him as well. It should be clearly understood, when I say backlash from the rest of the region may be preoccupied, but both leaders are going to face a backlash from those within their own populations who are not fans of the prospect of making these kinds of moves towards peace.
And this would include Hezbollah under Nasrallah as well, of course.
But Hezbollah right now is so preoccupied.
Very involved in Syria, yeah.
Yeah, and they're fighting something. In Syria, they're doing something that is completely unpopular within Lebanon. So they're doing something that is, in a sense, consuming. It's not just preoccupying, it's consuming to them. And that also gives, I think, Abu Mazen a bit more space than he would have otherwise. But the truth is, if you're going to make headway on this issue, it requires both leaders to take on history and mythology, never something that's easy to do. If it were an easy thing to have done, this would have happened already, and it hasn't. So it's understandable that each side, and observers will look at this and say, well, why is this going to be different this time than before? It's a legitimate question. My own view is that the context is a little different. The sense that there's more of a now or never kind of moment is a little different. You also have a kind of clear commitment from the secretary. You have the rest of the region preoccupied. All these things come together and create a possibility. A possibility doesn't produce a breakthrough, but at least it gives you a chance at a breakthrough.
Well, I like your congenital optimism, and forgive me if I sound like I'm being skeptical here, but you come up against these walls, and I don't mean the Wailing Wall. I mean Jerusalem, of course, specifically, but also you come up against the settlers. You got 600,000-plus settlers. Those inevitably, along the tract of Oslo or any other tract, have to be in some way reconciled, don't they?
Absolutely. Look, I've worked on this issue for a long time. I was our negotiator, you know, throughout the 1990s into the year 2000. And I'd be the last person to say that you don't face daunting challenges, and I wouldn't wish away the problems that either side faces. And clearly the settlers represent one of the issues. But if you look historically at what we were trying to do when we were at Camp David, we were coming up with what was going to be an approach on the borders that would create settlement blocks, and the settlement blocks were designed to accommodate about 80% of the settlers, and then you would have some kind of compensation for those blocks in the form of swaps. So there is conceptually a way to deal with that. It won't satisfy clearly all the settlers, but you might be in a position where you could accommodate, as I said, about 80% of them, in which case the mainstream of the settler movement might well not be in such opposition to you. There's clearly going to be a percentage who will be.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, again, counselor for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and former special assistant to President Obama and National Security Council's senior director for the Central Region. Appreciate very much your being with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me tell you who is with us for the hour here in studio. Abraham Sofer, a senior fellow with the Hoover Institution and served as legal advisor to Department of State from 1985 to 1990. He's also led the five-year negotiation between Egypt and Israel that settled the first I should say, the final disputes over the border at and near Taba in 1990. Welcome back, Abraham Sofer.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome back George Bisharat, who is professor of law at UC Hastings College of Law, former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. Good morning, and thank you for being here.
Thanks.
How much – let me begin, if I may, with you, Professor Bisharat, and just get your take on the fact that the settlements are in some way going to have to find some kind of traction, I presume.
Well, I don't think there's going to be any resolution of the settlements issue. I mean, we're not looking even at a pause in the ongoing colonizing juggernaut of the West Bank.
West Bank is going to continue.
It's going to get, yeah. It's I mean, you know, from January of this year until June, 15,800 housing units have been approved by the Israeli government. And the announcement has already been made that there will not be a settlement freeze during the negotiations. And I think that spells a probably rather short horizon even for these talks.
That was supposed to be a precondition, wasn't it? At least
well, from the Palestinian side, it was supposed to be a precondition. And there is no agreement on that issue. And the Israeli government has announced that they would only announce 1,000 new building starts during the coming 6 to 9 months, which is not going to cut it from the Palestinian side. It's not just a question of what the Palestinian negotiators and the leadership will agree to. It's what the Palestinian people themselves will tolerate and accept and think of as legitimate. And if their leadership is engaged in the continuation of essentially a cover or a sham negotiation that simply permits the Israeli colonization program to continue, then the leadership is simply not going to be able to – they're not going to be able to reach an agreement. They're not going to be able to continue with negotiations. They're going to face popular delegitimization and it'll go nowhere.
Sounds like an impasse to me, Abe Sofer. What about you?
No, if you insist on settling the settlement issue as part of a constructive negotiation, it is doomed. I mean, the negotiation – any negotiation that tries to address all the issues at one time is doomed because it's just too complicated and people aren't ready to do everything right away. But I think Dennis is right that they were close to something that would have settled 80% of the settlement issue by having a land swap for those settlements that are the most populated settlements that are very close to the borders. And settlements have not been an obstruction to peace with Egypt. They have Israel, four prime ministers of Israel have offered the Golan Heights back, despite the fact that there are settlements and wineries and whatnot up there. And the fact is that Israel moved out of Gaza and pulled out all its settlements unilaterally. So I think if everything else is in place, the settlement thing will not stop an effort for peace.
Well, George Bisharat, what about the fact that the Arab League is behind these peace talks? Doesn't that make a difference?
Should it make a difference? It makes a difference, but it won't change the negotiating space for the Palestinian leadership appreciably. So for their own public, for their own population, it will not change matters. It makes things easier on the international plane. It gives the Palestinian leadership a little bit of breathing room with respect to other governments. But with respect to the Palestinian population, they are watching closely what's going on the ground. And what's going on for them is, you know, the continuing violence of the occupation. 18 Palestinians have been killed since January of this year. 2,400 or so people have been arrested. 550 or so Palestinians have been made homeless by home demolitions. Palestinian private land continues to be confiscated for settlement. So this is the daily – and checkpoints, restrictions on freedom of movement, et cetera – this is the daily experience of Palestinians under occupation. And nothing that any negotiator states or anybody announces for the press is changing their actual reality. And if their reality doesn't change, then there's very little hope that these negotiations will bear fruit.
Professor Sofer, I mentioned the Arab League giving an endorsement of the peace talks. On the other side of it, you have the EU and the UN pretty much on the apparently on the Palestinian side. I mean, the European Union has put out, you know, some pretty strong statements on this and the possibility of this moving forward to the ICC, the International Court, against Israel.
Well, all of that can be disruptive. The key problem, though, is this notion of now or never, all or nothing. These notions are a disaster, potentially, for any progress. I keep seeing them. In 2000, that was the theme of the Clinton administration and its supporters, and it blew up in their faces. I wrote an op-ed piece.
You think Secretary
of State
Kerry is pushing too hard on
this? I think he is. I think he must, and I think Martin understands that this is a big mistake.
Martin Indyk.
Yeah. Nothing is worse than the notion that you have to solve everything. I agree with George, for example, when he says that things have to change on the ground. And there have been efforts in the past, in the prior negotiations, the Y agreement, the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement. There have been a lot of realization that things have to change on the ground. Power has to be decentralized to the Palestinians. And these are steps that need to be resumed. We now have stability there again. And one of the really sad things about the way this is all being played, from my point of view, is the prisoner release is being looked at as just a flat-out exchange of murderers for the opportunity to sit down and have dinner in Washington, D.C. with the Secretary of State. When, in fact, as Saeb Erekat points out, I think properly, all the pre-Oslo prisoners were supposed to be looked at for release in a process that was supposed to be handled by a committee after the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement in 1999. And this should be regarded as the resumption of that process. Instead of being seen as a total release of murderers in exchange for the possibility of talks, it should be seen as the resumption of a process that's professional, that's intense, and that isn't unrealistic.
Your sentiments are echoed by demonstrations that are going on in Israel, I believe, as we speak, of many of the families of these of those who were killed. Let me do this at this point. We're talking about the possibility of peace negotiations actually moving somewhere, moving toward, well, possibly even final status negotiations or some way of making a breakthrough. Obviously, as we heard earlier from Bloomberg foreign correspondent Indira Lakshmanan, there's a possibility that a lot was put up here and under the table, so to speak, in order to get these two parties to agree to talk. I'm interested in hearing what your thoughts are, and certainly we are going to continue with George Bisharat and Abraham Sofer and get their take on things, but like to hear yours as well and any questions or comments you might have, and you can bring them into the conversation right now. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us at that toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls, so feel free to make your voice heard. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address, simply forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. I think there's real prospect for peace here in the Middle East. Are you hopeful? Are you as pessimistic, perhaps, as many are, thinking that 20 years has gone by and we've not seen a major breakthrough? Maybe the time is now. After all, what we're seeing with all the turmoil and chaos in other parts of the Middle East, maybe a breakthrough can be reached. Let's hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Israeli and Palestinian officials are set to resume peace talks tonight in Washington, D.C. Actually, may have more to do with procedure and location and schedule for negotiations than actual negotiations. But this is the first time that both parties have held any kind of direct talk since 2010. And Secretary of State John Kerry had been shuttling back and forth, doing shuttle diplomacy to the Middle East to encourage a meeting. Last night, the Israeli cabinet signaled a move toward talks, voting to approve the release of 104 Palestinian prisoners, and we're discussing the conditions of reviving Palestinian-Israeli peace discussions and likelihood for success. And success does not necessarily mean, well, we were talking off air about the fact that Secretary of State Kerry talked about the possibility of in 6 to 9 months bringing a two-state solution. I think one has to bring a realistic point of view to bear on this and laser in on it and realize that maybe progress means something much less than that. But will there be, when I ask the question, will there be some kind of breakthrough? I mean, not necessarily, you know, a peace agreement to end all peace agreements. I mean, simply some kind of movement forward or progress. And Dara Lakshmanan was with us earlier, senior correspondent who covers foreign policy for Bloomberg News, and so was Ambassador Dennis Ross, counselor for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And with us for the remainder of the hour, Abraham Sofer, senior fellow with the Hoover Institution, and George Bisharat, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law and former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. Let's get your calls on here, and we begin, Camilla, with you. Good morning.
Hi. I'm calling because I just wanted to get the guest's opinion on the impact of the different methods of negotiation in this peace talk, and specifically looking back at the Oslo process, which has, you know, been recognized as a pretty successful attempt at negotiation, and looking at things like front channel versus back channel negotiation and, you know, the different mediators that are being brought to the table to discuss the issues. And, you know, how does the actual organization of the process impact the potential success of the process?
Good, important question. And let's hear first from you, Abraham Sofer. How is this negotiation going to be different than other negotiations, or will it be?
Well, we don't know yet. We certainly, that is certainly a correct observation. And it's a good sign that Secretary Kerry, who it should be applauded for his personal effort, is turning this over to an experienced diplomat, because it's not good for Secretary of State, followed by the press, et cetera, to be leading this kind of an effort where you're inevitably going to get slowdowns, backpedaling, et cetera. So turning it over to a process that might be a lot more confidential, should be a lot more confidential, and may even involve direct talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which should be welcomed by the U.S. because Oslo was a product of direct talks. And in fact, most of the solutions that the parties have brought to the process have been without the U.S. So you have to be look for any forum that's going to help and any context that's going to help. Don't require the Secretary of State of the United States to be flying back and forth incessantly, because he loses credibility ultimately that way.
Well, at least they're talking, one could argue, George Bisharat, but is what differs from Oslo in your judgment?
Well, I hate to say this, and my colleagues at Hastings who teach negotiations and mediation probably wouldn't appreciate me saying this, but I don't think that negotiation methodology is really the root of the problem here. I think what we have are two parties that have extremely different views of the end result. And I differ also from the caller in the characterization of Oslo as a successful negotiation. It was successful in the respect that it actually produced an agreement, but the agreement did not solve the fundamental problems. And in fact, I would say, Michael, you've said several times that it didn't create forward movement. I would say that what we have seen under Oslo is a considerable regression. We started Oslo with about 180,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Now we have close to 600,000. So the problems have only gotten worse. I regret to say this, but I really do think that we have to question whether American mediation is appropriate. We have declared to the world that we are Israel's strategic ally, that it's one of our closest friends, that there should be no daylight between our policies. We expect the world to accept us as honest brokers in negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, if these were two businesses, and one business was proposing that its parent company or some other closely allied company arbitrate or mediate between those two parties, you know, the business people on the other side would say that you're nuts. We would never accept such a thing. And I think
does
our—
Does that extend, in your judgment, to Martin Indyk being involved? I mean, who's not only an American but also is a Zionist and part of the New
Yes,
Israel Fund.
Yes, of course. But frankly, it hasn't been different under any other American negotiator. Yes, I do think we have to have not only the appearance but the actuality of impartiality. And we do not have that either with Martin Indyk or with other negotiators that we've had in the past.
Bring another caller in here, and we'll go next to a caller joining us from Massachusetts. Tom, you're on. Hi.
Thank you. I'm wondering about the possibility of a single state solution. It seems like the idea of any country strictly defined by an ethnic or religious identity is inherently racist or bigoted and anathema to our modern sensibilities, like, be it Muslim, Jewish, or Christian. And I'm just wondering, has the idea of a single state solution been thoroughly explored, and are there any proponents and adherents to that?
It's been thoroughly explored and thoroughly rejected, I think, for the most part, particularly in Israel, George Bishorat. Yeah.
Well, not entirely. I am a proponent of a single state solution because I agree with Tom that, in fact, you can't have a state that privileges one group over others when there are other people who live in the society who are not members of that privileged group. It is just a formula for perpetual conflict. We in the United States took the painful decision, over a century ago to go with the equality principle, and I think that same principle ought to be applied in Israel-Palestine. Right now, we have a situation in which Israel has 7 million. Citizens and 11 million subjects, we essentially have a functional single state. And what needs to happen is that people who live under Israeli rule need to have a political voice in the system that governs their daily lives.
Well, of course, Israel says they do. In fact, this whole issue about releasing Palestinian prisoners, some of whom are Israeli Arab citizens, Israeli says well, there are Arabs in their parliament, the Knesset, and there are also the fact that Arabs are citizens of Israel. Therefore, it's their sovereignty
I understand that the people in the occupied territories have no voice in the functional political sovereign in their region, which is Israel. And Palestinian citizens of Israel likewise suffer a variety of forms of legal and non-legal policy-type discrimination. And
let's keep in mind that Yehuda Magnus was a proponent of a single state, and many Israelis at that time joined him in that effort. And the idea was killed by Arab and Muslim hatred for Jews. And the war that was launched against Israel right after the declaration of Israel's independence, the Arabs were not even willing to recognize a sliver of a Jewish state. So it's just absurd to call for a single state and mean anything other than the subjugation of Jews to Islamic dominance. That's the way it is right now. It would be much better if the Muslims had accepted a single state. Then, as many Israeli Jews were willing to tolerate. But today, after this history of war after war, of hatred launched incessantly against Jews, murders of civilians, etc., it's impossible to talk about it. And that's why every U.S. administration, and why finally even Israel and the Palestinians have accepted the road to peace being a two-state solution, and the one state of Israel accepts Arabs as equal citizens. Now, I agree with George. There's still a long way to go in ensuring equality for Israeli Arabs, and they're working hard at it. But I would suggest to you, go to any hospital in Israel, and you will see the model for the future of Arabs and Jews living together in total peace and equality, because that's where you see Jews and Muslims working together, doctors, nurses, patients. There's no discrimination whatsoever in those halls.
Well, not only hospitals, but we've done programs on different factories and businesses in the West Bank.
Or universities.
That seem to operate.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the trend is definitely in the way that both George and I would like to see it, and that is equality of rights within Israel. But there's no way at this point that you could talk about a single state.
Well, you're going to talk about a single state. Well, actually, I'm going to read an email here from a listener. But you're going to have to bring in somehow the law of return, and you're going to have to bring in, for the Palestinians, and that along with Jerusalem, has been, and the settlements, of course, the major stumbling block. But a listener writes, considering that both sides want the whole of what was Mandate Palestine, and considering that the Palestinians will not feel satisfied until they can exercise their right of return, and considering that both the Israelis and the Palestinians want statehood, what would you think of implementing a different kind of two-state solution, two states on the same land forming a condominium in which both states have sovereignty over the same land and have shared governance on all matters of common concern as equals? Or another listener writes, I wonder if your guests agree that the U.S. current objective is to maintain the status quo, to give Israel more time to complete West Bank colonization by economically propping up the Palestinian Authority, which in reality does not represent most Palestinians and has neither authority nor credibility. And there's an argument that one often hears from Palestinian spokespeople, George Bisharat.
Yeah. I wouldn't go so far as to say that that's necessarily the U.S. intention, but that certainly is the effect.
Or the Israeli intention, actually, according to that listener. Because, in fact, under Prime Minister Netanyahu, there's been talk about a referendum and, you know, putting things to a vote. And some people say this is a way of getting time.
Right. Well, I may have misunderstood the writer's comment, but I thought what was being said was that the U.S. is buying time for Israel to continue colonizing the West Bank. I doubt, frankly, that that's the U.S. intention, but it is the effect of U.S. diplomacy. And it's not just in negotiations, but also the very active role that the United States has played in the United Nations and elsewhere diplomatically to protect Israel against the consequences of its violations of international law, particularly in the settlement enterprise. It's very clear to everyone outside of the United States that settlements violate international law in a variety of different ways for a variety of different reasons. That's what the International Court of Justice concluded by all 15 judges, including the American judge.
And we have an international judge with us here in studio who is in agreement with that. Disagree?
I disagree emphatically with the ICJ about not only about that decision. It was very casual, you know, for people to say it violates international law. It's a unique situation. That area has never been under the sovereign control of any state. So you do have a situation that just can't be compared. And the ICJ in that decision had the audacity to say that just because they were launching terrorist attacks on Israel that weren't from a formal government force, the Israel had no right of self-defense. You know, if you read that opinion and you see the kind of bias and the absurdity of some of their results— You could infer from that the likewise absurdity of their result on the issue of international illegality.
All right. When we're talking about one state and two state, I have to read another listener comment who writes, the growth of the religious right in Israel and the public call by many of them for a one state solution, by which I mean one Jewish state, scares the dickens out of me for the future of a democratic Israel. So, and then another listener writes, I'm tired of peace talks. If these groups really dislike each other, just let them fight it out. Peace without war first will never work. Everyone is being held back by the United States' insistence on getting in the way and coddling Israel. Let them all have their catharsis and violence.
They've had five of those, Michael.
Yes, they have indeed. Let me get some more callers on. And Mark, we go to you next. Good morning. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Michael.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for taking my call. Really enjoying the program. So, speaking of catharsis, it occurs to me that the conflict, Israeli and Palestinian conflict in the Middle East, really has many implications regionally and worldwide in terms of providing fuel to various groups who really benefit from that animosity and have for decades. So, I'm wondering how those groups and interests potentially impact the peace process, have in the past, may do so in the future, and by what mechanisms?
Can you be a little specific, Mark, about what groups you're talking about, just so we know?
Certainly. Well, for example, the conflict or the supposed subjugation of Palestinians by Jews has been a cause célèbre for many organizations throughout the Middle East, be it Iran, certainly various Arab nations and various groups that have or have not been declared terrorist organizations, and it's just sort of an age-old focus for a great deal of conflict. And then some of those groups, perhaps like Hezbollah, which tend to perpetuate themselves on the basis of their vehemence toward Israel, in large part perpetuated by that conflict, would dislike a peace ultimately.
Well, we talked earlier with Ambassador Dennis Ross, who said that Hezbollah has its own involvement in Syria now and is, shall we say, to put it mildly, balled up in that conflict, and has actually caused a great deal of concern within Lebanon, where they're located, because of that, because of the, well, the ongoing enmity, I suppose you could say, between Sunnis and those who support the Alawites, who are mainly Shiites. But I don't know if either of you want to comment here, George Bashar.
Well, you know, it is true that historically a number of governments and non-governmental organizations have had effect on Palestinian politics through Palestinian organizations. Some of them, you know, rump organizations that essentially represent the interests of those other states or organizations. But I think the Palestinians themselves are really in the driver's seat. And if those outside groups cannot gain purchase within the Palestinian population itself in substantial percentages or proportions, then they don't really have much purchase on the direction of Palestinian politics. In other words, if Palestinians want to conclude a peace deal and they believe that they have one that satisfies their interest, they'll go ahead and.
But again, you're talking about the Palestinian Authority, not about Hamas.
No, I'm talking about the Palestinian people as a whole. Oh.
And George,
the thing that needs to be said here is this idea that the rest of the world is being affected by what happens between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The notion of granddaddy is inaccurate, both historically, because it isn't the oldest peace problem in the Middle East, nor is it the biggest at all. What would happen differently right now around Israel? What would be happening differently but for Israel and Israel's problems with the Palestinians? Egypt, what's going on in Egypt has nothing to do with Israel. What's going on in Syria has nothing to do with Israel. What's going on in Iran has nothing to do with Israel. It's absurd. Artificially inflating the importance of a negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, you're really creating a crisis-type environment, which is not conducive to very serious professional negotiating to establish progress, not some kind of, you know, we're going to solve this in 6 months. There's just no relationship. You have to be professional about it and practical about it. And that's what I don't see, and that's what gives me reason to concern.
Well, let's find out what more of our listeners have to say. We go, Van, to you. Good morning, Van.
Fighting in Syria, do you folks see any emerging factions either inside Hamas or outside in Lebanon that would be more focused on the Palestinian fight? I'll get my answer up here.
Okay, thank you for the call. George?
Well, I think you must mean Hezbollah, not Hamas.
Yeah,
Hamas is not fighting in Syria. In fact, Hamas, because of its concern and disgust over the behavior of the Syrian government toward its people in the early days of the uprising, decided to leave Damascus and no longer use that as its primary foreign base of operations.
But forgive me, George, there are certainly jihadi warriors who are going in to fight against Assad on the side of the Sunni opposition.
Sure. And Hezbollah, of course, has actively intervened to support the Syrian government. But that has nothing to do with Hamas or the Palestinians.
Let me bring another caller on here. We go next to you. David, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I'm very concerned that George has probably three or four times focused on, you know, his word colonization in the West Bank. I wonder if he'd like to address the fact that the Palestinians continue to produce maps that don't have Israel on it. They continue to indoctrinate children with plays and television shows glorifying martyrs. And I wonder when he plans on taking responsibility for some of that.
I don't know if it's your personal responsibility here, George, but I think you get the gist of the question.
Sure. No, I mean, I'm not personally responsible for those things, and I don't take responsibility for them. Of course, both sides produce maps that do not recognize the sovereign rights of the other people. That goes on in Israeli schools as much as it goes on in Palestinian schools. By the way, there are frequently these allegations about what's taught in the Palestinian curriculum or not. And there have been careful academic studies of what, in fact, that is represented in those texts. And they generally do not support these rather lurid allegations about what is taught to Palestinian children or what's on Palestinian television. This is a people, the Palestinian people, who see themselves as fighting against a foreign colonial occupying army. And they are fighting against much more powerful forces, much more militarily capable, economically capable, diplomatically capable. And there are aspects of culture and teaching that prepare those people for resistance. Now, you know, I wish it didn't have to be that way. I wish the occupation would end, that Palestinians wouldn't be killed on a relatively regular basis, that their land wouldn't be taken away, that their homes wouldn't be demolished. If those things were to stop, I think Palestinians would be perfectly happy to live normal lives as much as any other people. They love peace and security just like anybody else.
But let me give you a follow up, and then we'll hear from Abraham Sofer. Sure. And this often comes up whenever this discussion about the Middle East and peace between Palestinians and Israelis. This is a listener from San Rafael who writes, "The Palestinians will get their state, and there is no reason to believe it will not be like all other states, violent, Islamic, intolerant, women treated terribly with no Israeli Supreme Court to redress grievances. The unfortunate truth is Muslims are treated better in the Jewish state than in any Arab state." Hear this, of course.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, and it's nonsense, frankly. I think there is a struggle within Palestinian society to democratize. Frankly, the United States has not always been supportive of democratic elements either in the surrounding Arab countries or among the Palestinians.
But tried with Morsi to some extent.
Yeah, well, we could do better. I mean, frankly, Vice President Gore, praised the state security courts that then Prime Minister Arafat, before his death, instituted in the occupied territories that abused the rights of the people under occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. We have not consistently supported democratic forces in Palestinian society. I agree that there has to be a thorough democratization of Palestinian society, and that's actually the focus of my current research and writing at this time.
Abe Sofer.
I don't have any doubt that George is sincere in his hopes and beliefs. But you'd have to be blind not to realize that the democratic secular forces in the Muslim world, in the Middle East in particular, are fighting an uphill battle. They have very little influence in these countries, and they have a long way to go before they accept, especially the Palestinians, that Jews have a right to live in peace. It just isn't there.
Let me bring a caller on who's joining us from Texas. Farid, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I'd like to know, Mr. Martin Indyk, who you've been referring to him as a Zionist a couple of times, what does that mean and what effect could that have on him as far as being a negotiator between the two sides?
Well, how do you see it, George Bisharon?
Well, he's a man who has a history of working with the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the principal pro-Israel lobbying organization in the United States, his personal beliefs and his personal history attest to support for Israel.
Although he seems to have the trust of Abu Mazen.
Well, apparently so. I said earlier, we need to have both the appearance and the actuality of impartiality. Martin Indyk, may be one of those people who's capable of putting his personal beliefs aside and acting professionally and being impartial. I don't know. He may be.
Could I add a couple of words, since I do know Martin Indyk very, very well? He will not put his personal beliefs aside. His personal belief is that it is in the best interests of the Jewish people and of Israel to make a fair peace with the Palestinians. He's very much in favor of a two-state solution. He's very much in favor of sharing Jerusalem. He's very much in favor of solving these problems. So he may be a caring Jew in the sense that you call every caring Jew a Zionist, but he is a completely committed to the American policy of trying to solve this problem in a fair way that recognizes the full rights of the Palestinian people.
We only got a couple minutes left. I want to read a listener's comment here, which I think is salient. He says, can your guests please elucidate why the public doesn't get to hear what the real crux of the peace negotiations is or ought to be, that being the fact that everything hinges on access to sufficient water and arable land from whoever gets land. That's why there is rampant settlement development, what the Palestinians are fighting for. Instead, we hear endless distracting, hate-fueled arguments about the survival of the Jewish state and Arabs hating Jews and other overbreeding Palestinians. The real topics are age-old matters of land and water. So long as the participants continue to be closed-lipped about that, the world arena, then the current dishonest stalemate will persist. Shaking your head no.
She doesn't know what she's talking about. The water problem has been largely solved with the desalination plants along the Israeli coast, and the parties have to just coordinate, build some sewage plants, build a couple more desalination plants, and decide that they're going to let the Palestinians use the water that's up in the hills and let the Israelis use the water that's desalinated.
Oh, we got seconds left. George Bouchard, do you disagree?
Yeah, I do disagree, unfortunately. You know, it really is about land and about access to land and other natural resources. Water is one of them. There are other resources at stake as well, even the electromagnetic field over, you know, Israel has not permitted Palestinians to have 3G network, for example. And it is still the crux of the problem as I see it.
We'll have to end it there. Thank you, George Bisharat. Thank you, Abraham Sofer. Thanks also to Ambassador Dennis Ross and Indira Lakshmanan from Bloomberg News. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll. And to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, our engineer, Danny Bringer, and our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.